Hello, creeps. Your mysterious old hosts are taking a few weeks off to enjoy the summer and attend to various and sundry theatrical projects. In the meantime, we invite you to enjoy a selection of episodes from our Patreon-only back catalog. This week, we present a true oddity, a never-before-released pilot for our unmade Columbo podcast. If you enjoy the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society and want to hear more in-depth discussions of old-time radio, along with outliers like this Columbo episode, please visit patreon.com/themorals and become a member today.
Hi.
Is this your dog?
Yeah, I guess it is.
How would you like it if somebody locked you up like that? With the windows closed and everything.
Well, I didn't want him to get out.
Okay, then leave the window open a crack.
Okay, it's a good idea. You see, this happens to be my first dog, and I just haven't gotten onto the ropes yet.
What's his name?
You know, I don't know the name yet. What do you think about Fido?
Oh, wow. How'd you ever think of that one?
Beto. You like to be called Beto? Guess not.
A podcast named Dog.
Oh, wow. How'd you ever think of that one?
Welcome to the inaugural episode of A Podcast Named Dog, a series dedicated to investigating the mysterious appeal of our favorite TV detective, Columbo. I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua. We love a great Columbo episode. The format, the performances, the dialogue, the plot twists, and the whole 70s vibe. Or the 80s, 90s vibe for later seasons. Does this episode put it all together for a perfect solution? Or is it just one more thing to grouse about? That's what we're here to find out.
Today, we'll be discussing the first episode of the show's second season, Etude in Black. Stephen Bochco wrote this script while show creators Richard Levinson and William Link are credited with the story. Bochco would later work with Michael Kozol to create Hill Street Blues and with Terry Louise Fisher to create L.A. Law. Other Bochco productions include Doogie Howser, M.D., Cop Rock, and NYPD Blue.
As with just about every episode of Columbo, Etude in Black features an amazing array of guest stars. Gentlemen, who do we have in the cast today?
We have Blythe Danner playing Janice Benedict. Danner has won 2 Primetime Emmy Awards and, for her Broadway performance in Butterflies Are Free, she won a Tony Award in 1970. In addition to a film, TV, and stage career that has spanned more than 50 years, she also has 2 children, Jake and Gwyneth Paltrow.
The one and only Myrna Loy appears as Lizzie Fielding, Janice Benedict's mother. Loy's first film role was back in 1925, but it wasn't until 1934 that she would take on her most memorable role, Nora Charles from the Thin Man series of films. She continued to perform in films and television for over 60 years until she passed away in 1993.
Pat Morita makes a brief cameo appearance. Although he had a few film credits when he appeared in Columbo, he was primarily known as a stand-up comedian at this point. He would, of course, go on to play Arnold Takahashi in Happy Days, Mr. Miyagi in the Karate Kid films, as well as many other roles.
In playing the role of Alexander Benedict, John Cassavetes is the episode's contribution to the Murderer's Row. In addition to helping to pioneer independent cinema in America, Cassavetes was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role in The Dirty Dozen, and would later earn nominations as both a writer and a director. He frequently collaborated with Peter Falk on his films, and the two were close friends.
Before we begin our discussion of Etude in Black, just in case it's been a while since you've seen the episode, allow us to refresh your memory with a dramatic reenactment of the crime with this installment of Perfect Murder Theater.
As the story begins, the first part of my plan to murder this woman is to play the piano. Then I smoke a cigarette, then I go upstairs, then I turn on a lamp, then I pour a drink. Then I sit down. Then I turn on the radio.
You can probably skip all this.
These are vital details. Vital! Where was I? I turn on the radio. Then I drink. Then I turn up the radio. Then I stand up and get my briefcase. I unlock my desk with a set of keys attached to what might be a burnt marshmallow keychain. I pull out a towel and put it in my briefcase. I put on a pair of gloves and then retrieve a typewritten suicide note on a piece of stationery with Jennifer Wells printed on it.
Ooh, now we're getting to it.
Now I put the note in the briefcase, followed by the gloves. I take the case downstairs, get in my fancy car.
It's a Jaguar.
I drive to a repair shop.
Hello, Governor. I'm your repairman.
He's British?
What seems to be the problem?
Would it help if I described it with vague orchestra metaphors?
I'll get right on it. Can I give you a ride?
No, my wife is... Hold on. I do not need a ride because my wife is giving me a ride, after which I will not have access to a car.
Beep, beep.
There she is.
I have to wash my hands.
That's a little weird.
I go into the bathroom and I unlock the window, but don't open it.
I always get yelled at when I don't open the window.
Then my wife drives me to the Hollywood Bowl, where I'll be conducting a symphony. I tell her lewd anecdotes about composers. I'm a jerk to the producers. And then I make sure that everyone knows that I will be in my room alone until 8 p.m. and I must not be disturbed. This way everyone will want to avoid me because I seem like a volatile artistic genius.
Or a 13-year-old boy.
Then everything goes blurry and suddenly... I'm wearing a tuxedo.
That's usually how I get out of tuxedos.
Also, I'm wearing a distinctive-looking boutonniere. Then I sneak out, run to the repair shop, which is closed, sneak into the bathroom, butt first, lower the hydraulic lift holding my car, open the garage, drive out, stop, get out of the car, close the garage door.
Are you going to kill someone soon?
I drive to Jennifer Wells' house. She's playing the piano, and I sneak up on her, and...
Kill her?
I give her a big hug. But I scared her, and she says...
I was feeling all the hairs on the back of my neck.
And I say, that's just sex.
That's very weird.
I'm so glad you decided to divorce your wife.
If I divorce my wife, I lose her mother's money and support.
But if you don't, I'll ruin you with our scandalous affair. I just knew that threatening you with an ultimatum was the perfect way for us to be together. What other option do you have?
Face the other way for a second.
Okay.
And then I...
Hit her with an ashtray!
Whoa. I put on my gloves, wrap the ashtray in a towel I brought, and then I hit her in the back of the head, shocking her cockatoo.
Oh, I saw Shocking Your Cockatoo open for Flesh for Lulu at First Avenue. They were so good.
Then I drag her body into the kitchen. I blow out every pilot light on the stove and then turn on the gas. I stage her body so it appears as if she's fallen out of a stool and struck her head against the floor. I test it myself, and... end up lying on top of her.
Super weird.
Mm-hmm. I insert the suicide note into her typewriter and take the phone off the hook. Then I leave, walking past a girl and her dog in broad daylight. I get back into my super conspicuous car and drive back to the repair shop, restoring it to its place. Finally, I run back to my dressing room in time to conduct the orchestra, eventually noticing that somewhere along the line, I lost my super distinctive boutonniere. Eh? Perfect crime, huh?
That was more or less the setup to Etude in Black, an episode which was first broadcast September 17th, 1972, and which features the debut of Dog, for whom this podcast was named. And now, let's get into it, boys. How do you think the investigation went?
Here's the first observation I have.
Yes.
This is the 8 millionth story I have seen, be it a movie or TV show or a cartoon, where the conductor is just an asshole, leading me to believe that all conductors of orchestras are assholes.
So you think if you're in an orchestra and you see Bugs Bunny coming up, you think, oh, thank God.
Right.
This is the good one.
Yes. Think about it. I have yet to see an episode of Law and Order where they go and interview the guy that conducts an orchestra, which is about four of them. And they're always the murderer, and they're always such jerks to everybody. Have you ever seen a conductor portrayed as a really nice, giving person?
I'm sure some conductor has written an autobiography in which
he was screaming at people.
Yes.
I'm gonna tell you,
life as an asshole.
I'm going to tell you, there's conductors out there that are like, will you please stop portraying me? I tap on the thing, go, hey, could you crescendo a little more? Thank you. Like, there's got to be nice conductors.
Well, here's my deal with conductors. And I've read a couple reviews of this episode that gave John
Dirty Dozen guy.
That guy.
John.
Some stick for his bad conductor acting. And to me, all conductors look ridiculous. It seems very performative. It seems like they want to say, I'm working hard too, even though I don't have an instrument.
Wow.
To me, it's like a guy riding in the passenger seat of a race car making like pedaling gestures the entire time.
I didn't realize I was going to be the one to defend conductors here.
Joshua and I, that's the most we've ever agreed on anything.
I
can't agree more. I think it's a made up profession.
One, I have to give a little sympathy to anyone who has to play conductor because they have to wave the stick around. They have to do the conducting motions, make these choices, and the editors just don't care if what you're doing matches the music or not.
Right.
But I went to a school and was part of the choir that had a pretty extensive music department, and so we'd get student conductors in.
Yes.
And I got to know, like, oh, I get now why conductors do what they do, that they have one arm, that this is the arm that keeps time, one arm that is meant to gesture to whichever instrument is supposed to be doing whatever particularly important thing that they are sort
of. But doesn't the music in front of you tell you what you're supposed to do and how fast?
If you had a play with, like, 80 people on stage, and, you know, in theory they would have rehearsed, but. Like, okay, so if I had a play with 80 people on stage, clearly we didn't rehearse.
Right.
But I'm on stage there, so I can gesture to them, you suck less. You over there, be expressive.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. I think directors are useless as well.
What? We're two for two over here, Scrooge and I. No, hold on. And I know we're trying to be funny a little bit here, but seriously.
This was not the conversation I thought we'd be having.
No, this is where it starts, and this is where. Listen, if they've rehearsed it and they have the music in front of them, are they actually looking up and going, oh, thank God he's doing a thing because I have no idea what this is supposed to be doing?
It's not so much like, do I need to know what he wants me to do right now? Is there's 80 of us. We all got to be on one page. And I can watch the guy next to me and the guy next to me on the other side, but I can't watch the whole orchestra. So the whole orchestra watches this one guy.
Who's just keeping beat with his right hand.
That's kind of the dirty secret, is mostly he just keeps beat.
And that goes back to my original point, all jokes aside, that I feel conductors are overly performative. They would not need to be quite as dramatic as they are. They are upstaging.
A big stick attached orchestra. To a metronome could do the same thing.
Wow. I mean.
Right?
A metronome with tails. Right.
But no, you put a flag on it. It's like, look here.
Probably just like, oh, this metronome is so exaggerated.
You know who's not going to be a Patreon?
Conductors.
Yes. We've lost conductors.
Train conductors, too. I just hate conductors.
Also, my electrical outlets. They don't do anything. All right, from that.
That's our new Columbo podcast.
But am I right in that conductors are very, very rarely, I can't remember ever them being portrayed as really nice people.
No, you're right.
They're always jerks.
It is a common trope.
And maybe
the
they
same,
are.
Though, is can be said of directors. We made the joke earlier about directors. That was only half a joke on my part. But, I think it's because they're the ones in charge of
Law and Order again.
Artists, right? So, like, by definition, they're a wily group of people. And so they are often portrayed and probably in real life have to be more of a disciplinarian.
But specifically in Columbo, choosing to have an conductor as the antagonist. Columbo is always this iconoclast who's set against authority figures. there would be no purpose in having a really nice guy conductor.
No, I'm just saying yeah. They could pick a lot of people to write a story about who commit murder.
Or they could have two conductors, like the nice one and the...
Right. There's never a good guy conductor who's... He's always the murderer.
But like conductors and directors are like the equivalent of management though, right? Because sure. They take credit for the work of the whole.
Yep. So like that's coaches part of it in as well. Sports.
Yep.
Which also overrated.
Like, you know, for all the directing I've done, like, yeah, that's a lot of credit I got for that. So much credit.
All right. I want to talk about the guest stars really quick. Mm-hmm. Myrna Loy. Not Myrna Loy. I don't want to start with her. I want to start with Blythe Danning. Two things. First, I didn't know that Gwyneth Paltrow was her kid. Well, I had no
she's
idea.
She's pregnant with Gwyneth Paltrow during this.
Okay.
I read that later because I went, is she pregnant?
Okay.
There's some scenes where she's carrying her jacket over her front and things like that.
So I never knew that about Gwyneth Paltrow. Second, I stared
was birthed from another woman?
Yes. But I'm looking at Blythe Danner. And I can't remember what it is that I remember her most from. And I thought it would be in her intro. And it wasn't. What
she
is
Meet the Parents.
Meet the Parents? No.
That was a big one. Comedy
she,
movie.
She won her Emmys for a show called Huff.
Nope.
But she has been in so many. She, Will I know. Grace?
Nope.
She's more ubiquitous.
She's been in a lot of stuff.
I know.
A star that is associated with a single performance.
Right. I'm just trying to trigger in my head. Aha! That's where I know you from.
Columbo.
Maybe it was this. All right. Second, I'm watching this woman and I'm going, where do I know her from? And I can't figure it out. But then I stopped thinking about it because her performance is exquisite. And then later I went, oh, it's Myrna Loy. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at her going, where do I know her? Where do I, you know, like I'm really familiar and her style and how she talked and everything. But then I just went, I don't care anymore. I love you, whoever you are.
Oh, it's like,
such a good performance in that scene.
Looking at, like, what's her resume? And a femme fatale starting in 1925.
Yeah.
And this is 45 years later, close to 50 years later. And, like, she's awesome.
So she was around during Prohibition. So he was right. Yes. Yeah, she's fantastic. And that scene... Columbo and the trumpet guy, and she's just sitting
Paul.
There.
Angry trumpet man.
Yeah.
Angry trumpet man. Again, you ever seen a trumpet guy portrayed? No, I'm just... but she's so good in that.
My favorite scene with her is the scene in the restaurant where she's having dinner with her daughter and the newspaper man, or not man, they're the people who own the newspapers, come walking in and she does damage control to make sure there aren't going to be stories about the dead pianist. And that is that moment where you realize she's a protective mother, but she's not protective of her daughter. She's protecting the orchestra is her child that she cares about.
She even says it later.
Yeah. But
she, orchestra first.
Yeah, but in that moment you realize, oh,
right.
And just how controlling she is. And then it's also a great scene because you realize not only is Janice really under the thumb of Alex, the conductor, the maestro, who tells her that all her worries about other women are silly. She's also treated the same way by her mother. And it's really kind of a sad scene where her mother just goes, oh, who cares about that woman? Because she asks, would men find her attractive, do you think? Like, she was a pianist. She matters nothing. Right. And then she goes, let me order for you.
Right.
And the scene cuts away. It's like, oh, this poor woman.
Yep. But she seems less controlling and more approachable and more likable in the other scene with angry trumpet guy. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, because he's so pathetic.
I'm just saying how she approached that scene as an actor, possibly. She's less cantankerous.
Well, the thing is...
She's also in the position to... She is being magnanimous in that scene.
Yeah. Well, and also in each scene, she's in control. And so it depends who else is in that scene. She's utterly in control of the scene with her daughter, but you feel sympathetic toward her daughter. Mm-hmm. She's utterly in control in the scene with Paul, the stoner, drunk trumpet player, and you don't
That's
feel
trumpet players are always stoners, drunks. And
you don't feel a lot of sympathy for him at that point.
Right.
Because he comes out with that great excuse for his being charged with assaulting a woman. That is one of those things where the explanation raises far more questions than the actual charge, and you just should have been quiet. It's like,
where were you that you were caught off guard by a woman trying to steal your wallet?
While you were asleep, and you just woke up swinging and connected with her, and that's the end of my defense.
Right? Yeah, where was this? So here's something for this inaugural podcast I want to get out of the way.
Awesome.
I've seen a lot of Columbo. I know the shtick, but I haven't really sat down and watched Columbo like I should, right? Like all of them.
You're gonna.
I know, but but like if it's on and I have time and that strikes me at that moment, I'll go, oh yeah, I'll watch that. And then I watch it and go, that was great. But I'm not like, it's not like Law and Order with me or Star Trek or, you know, there's
Cop Rock, Doogie Howser.
Right. But you know those things that like I know this really well, but I don't know it. So there's some interesting things I'm going to learn. For example, I was unaware of the whole dog thing when we named the podcast this, and I didn't know. And then when we watched it, and then I went, oh, this is the first one where he gets his dog and that he has a dog named Dog. Just not something that clicks with me that I remember. Now I do kind of. All right, his dog, the big basset hound or whatever it is.
So, I love that dog so much.
Yeah. He's a good actor. So there's going to be these things that I'm not quite an aficionado on, and probably I should know more about those kind of things.
If you're trying to say don't judge you.
No.
Too late.
It actually is leading to this next thing. I don't have enough knowledge of it to say, is this something they did constantly or just this episode? And that is giving away clues with camera snaps to him recognizing his boutonniere is gone, to a close-up of the boutonniere on the floor, when he does the girlfriend's phone number and they snap the camera into her face to show.
Give us zoom.
The clue zoom.
Yeah.
I like it better when they just kind of float by me and then the detective in a show tells me later, oh, that's right. I didn't catch it. This is hitting us over the head with the clues.
Interesting to me.
Do they do this in all the episodes?
They experiment a lot. They do all kinds of things.
Okay.
What was interesting to me in this one was like, it was so obvious, almost pointedly obvious about the boutonniere.
Yeah.
And talking to the producer and like, mm-hmm. I have cameras on me all the time during this concert. It's clear as day. I don't have the boutonniere.
Right.
But I forgot that there's cameras on him to show that he had it on his way out of the house.
Oh, I caught that right away. I went, oh, he's on camera. He's got that boutonniere on. And I get that all Columbos, we pretty much know who the guy is. But I like more of finding out how they figured it out
was
than we had.
Interesting to me in this one is this one. The air quotes perfect murder had a lot of flaws in it. It had a lot of problems. So I wasn't so much amazed that Columbo navigated through all the twists and turns and found it. But the earlier part where he manages to get enough proof or is convincing enough to make it not a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
That was the part of the story that interested me in that initial little conversation, that scene about this is what the police report gives me. This is what her scrapbook tells me.
Well, that's fascinating from a story point of view, but it's also, to my recollection, and I have watched all these Columbos out of order in over years, so I am far from a expert on the linear
sure.
Columbo canon. But it seems to me, based on my memory, to be a rare moment where we see Columbo being very genuine.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a lot of scenes where he takes any time to talk about or muse on the victim. And here we see that he is making a real connection with this woman. I mean, he's obsessed with her eyes, bedroom eyes, beautiful eyes.
Right.
He likes her eyes. But there's a sadness here. And because he's not putting on a show for any suspects, it's just a peer who's sitting there.
Yeah.
I feel like you can read that from an audience point of view as Columbo genuinely describing some of his motives and some of his perspectives on murder.
Yep.
And he says that, you know, he's paranoid. If I see a dead body, I'm convinced it's been murdered. And he's also has that sweet line that, for me, I would like to see everyone die of old age. Yep. And so...
he has that twist. No, I want to watch them die
slowly with a drink in my hand and some popcorn. Especially conductors. But most of the time that you see Columbo, he is in performance mode. And part of the appeal of the character is to know what's real Columbo and what is show Columbo. And is he like that at home with his wife? And so this was a great peek into Columbo.
The real.
At home.
At home. Because he's with his captain or buddy. I love that guy, by the
way. Sergeant. I think he's a.
I think
that guy was really odd. Go back and watch it. The character choices as an actor, his voice, his body movements, it was odd. He was odd, man. Like, no one caught that? Oh, okay.
The
he was weird.
Supporting actors throughout the whole series are just this weird mix of genius and not just, genius.
And not actors. Like the...
Carlos?
Yes, Carlos, but also the...
Sorry if Carlos wasn't an actor who really captured the spirit of Guard.
The orchestra board meeting where it was like they ran out of money. They spent it all on Myrna Loy and location shooting at the Hollywood Bowl. And the like board members were just like the sandwich crew or something. It was not a stellar performance as they sat and very woodenly argued their points.
Yes. Here's an interesting thing. I don't know if this was true at the time or if they made it up for the show, but apparently all of America tuned in for a good classical music broadcast.
Oh, and want to watch it over and over again.
Watch it over and over again. I don't believe it had. You know, I love classical music. It's pretty much all I listen to, just so you know. So
my grandparents were so addicted to Lawrence Welk.
Welk, that's one. But that ain't classical music. What I'm saying is I don't think it's as popular as they were making it look.
However, they did try to do a sneaky cover for that, because did you see the marquee in the early scene as the maestro and his wife are walking toward the Hollywood Bowl?
Yes.
It says, young people's concert.
Oh, that's
like,
right.
Like he's some sort of
cutting edge
classical music composer that is really drawing in the crowds. And then later, the vet did admit he's watching it on public television.
Right.
And so this isn't on CBS.
All of this really goes, big with veterinarians.
So all of this goes again. This is not a gigantic popular thing. It's on PBS for starters.
Yeah.
Second, I know there was only four channels back then, but
and what's actually popular, I think they make the joke in the first visit to the vet that he's working late hours, which is why he's able to see Dog, because his wife won't let him watch concerts at home. She's watching what most people watch, mystery shows. So she's the vet's wife is at home watching her husband in Columbo.
That was my brain.
Yeah. One of the things.
I'm sorry. I looked it up. I just want to make this really clear. There's absolutely no evidence of Beethoven being a sex maniac. None. And when you actually look that up online, all the references are to this episode of Columbo referring. Is that true? So that's a weird little thing they made up in there.
I Googled a lot after watching this, but it was not Beethoven's sex maniac.
Oh, there's a website I can't scrub.
All of his references, his anecdotes about composers, I looked all of them up.
It was funny because they mentioned Beethoven as a sex addict, and then Beethoven is later one of the names that Columbo considers for Dog. I had that nightmarish moment where I thought of an alternate universe in which Charles Grodin played Columbo.
That movie.
Sorry.
What's your verdict
on... I killed the podcast with a Beethoven film franchise reference.
What is your verdict on child actor?
I thought that was really charming and funny. I liked it. Is it controversial?
No,
I don't know what Columbo opinions are.
It was such a strong choice of, like, the precocious level is high.
It's high. She comes right out of the gate like, I know my rights. I know animal rights. I know all the rights.
Precocious is really a grates on me fast with child actors. And you're right. She comes out of the gate flying and nothing about her bothered me.
I didn't go,
oh, child actor stuff.
There's a moment where I rewound it several times that I was convinced that Peter Falk almost broke. And that is when he goes to talk to her in
the dance studio.
Yes. And he says, I got to tell you something. I'm very impressed with you. And she goes, is it my body or my mind?
Right.
And then Columbo says, it's both. No, seriously, give me a break. There's that moment where you see this smile on his face where I'm like, I thought for sure he was going to just crack up laughing. I seriously doubt give me a break was in the script. I think that was him going, kid, you're killing me.
Right. I got obsessed with that scene of watching the kids in the dance class and the dance instructor in the mirror behind them, because all I could think about is, first of all, they shot that scene how many times? And their job was, you're on camera because you're in this giant mirror. Just keep dancing. Just keep dancing. Just keep moving. And I couldn't stop watching them as extras, which I have a huge problem with in general. I can't take my eyes off extras. I want to catch funny, weird extra stuff. So, anyway, I don't know what that scene was about.
I was a little fascinated by the dance teacher's adept handling of a person comes into the studio.
Yes.
I understand they want that person. I get that person's attention. I navigate all this, getting these people together without speaking a word or stopping dancing.
Just a nod.
It's like, so homicide detectives must regularly stop by his ballet class and interrogate 12-year-olds.
Which one do you want?
Sandy, it's you this week.
Well, we have yet to talk about my two favorite scenes in this episode.
All right.
So I'm going to just pull the trigger on it. Scene one, and I read somewhere that this was a filler scene, that the network wanted
the
expand the length of Columbo because it was so popular and they could get more advertising dollars.
An hour and a half length total, including advertising, to 2 hours total with this episode.
But it was filmed as if it was going to be an hour and a half, and they went back and added scenes.
Okay.
And the scene that they – or one scene that I read that they added is one of my two favorites, and that is when he goes to the conductor, the maestro's house, and confronts him.
It's the Pat Morita scene too.
Yeah.
The what scene?
Pat Morita.
Oh, that's such padding.
Oh, but it's such a brilliant scene.
To me, it's we need like a 5-10 minutes, you two improvise.
Right.
Because he comes in. And the only narrative information, because now I found it out retroactively, but they're handcuffed because they've completed it. There's no real significant information to add.
Other than the autograph?
There's nothing in here. So what they go with is like, well, we're going to establish his wealth, which had already been established.
Sure.
But they do it in a way that is so fun because Columbo...
Doing the math. Yeah.
And the way he does it, though, it's more aggressive and hostile. There's a bit of like class warfare going on in here. And not only that, the direction choice, because this whole scene is about describing the opulence of his lifestyle, but they choose to keep the camera just on the foyer of the house.
Right.
And so when they want to describe the other rooms, they just have Columbo walk over and look past the camera and go, that's got to be a 40-foot living room, and describe it all like an old-time radio show to everybody, and then go look in the opposite direction. And it's just – the other thing I love about it, he was making me go, oh, this guy is just so rich, and he's married into it. It's not earned money, and and then he says, I only make $11,000, and I'm like, yeah, he only makes $11,000, and then I went on the inflation calculator and went, you make more than I do in 2022.
What is it,
Columbo? It was $78,000 a year.
That's more than I make.
Like, never mind. I'm on conductor man's side now.
You should marry into it.
conductor man. So what's your second favorite?
I think it's a brilliant scene because the whole time there's this all this tension. They create tension that Columbo's got a real question here, and then it ends on the autograph, and I'm like, and
nothing.
Nope.
What's the second favorite scene?
Columbo in an abandoned Hollywood bowl playing chopsticks on a piano. That is perhaps the greatest Columbo.
And you know what's great when he claps about Falk's choice? Not to go, oh, sorry, I didn't see you come in. He just turns with a big grin, like, right?
Yeah, and he's got an audience. Right? And he keeps playing. He's like, oh, cool. Yeah, conduct me.
Instead of, oh, sorry, you caught me, which would have been my... That would have been my instinct
as
an actor.
Bowl. Everyone knows you're there playing chopsticks.
Wouldn't that be your instinct as an actor? They start clapping, you just turn around and stop.
Yeah.
But Falk just smiles and keeps going. It's really cool.
But Columbo has probably been playing chopsticks for 4 hours.
waiting
for him to walk in so he could annoy him by playing chopsticks.
Yep.
That is in the technicalities of the investigations, those things that fascinate me. Like, you don't have a case. You're just badgering these people.
Mm-hmm.
But he's always doing, though, right?
Yes.
That's the premise, is the badgering.
A nice touch that's in this. They do things like this in other episodes, too, but I'll point it out here, was the video camera trick of when Cassavetes walks into the crime scene and he's looking for the boutonniere, putting the image of the boutonniere in his glasses.
He has Clu-ray glasses.
Yes.
I almost ordered them from the back of a comic book.
Clu-ray. I got it.
I was initially really, really bummed out at the death of the bird.
Yeah.
But there was a cut scene in which the bird was talking to the woman and saying, look, you need to give him an ultimatum. This guy, I think, needs to leave his wife.
Which would make us want the bird dead.
Right. I stake my life on he will leave his wife and be with you. And bird got what's coming to it.
Bird reacted well. Bird did some fine reacting to the ashtray to the head.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
What did they do to the bird when they were filming it to get it to jump like
that? They kept hitting that lady over and over again. Bigger!
Hit her again.
The bird's like, give me something to react to.
Wait, who was the woman that got killed actor-wise? Anybody?
I can't think of her name now. I looked up, and she has a resume and several works, but is...
Anjanette Kummer.
Thank you.
No.
I think model actress... /model/actress?
Yeah, when I looked at her, she's one of those actors that just is in a little bit of everything all over the place.
There was a point at which in her Wikipedia page it said, after this point, she stopped acting.
Oh. Did you see her eyes? Her eyes are crazy.
So much to live for.
Beautiful.
Bedroom eyes.
We heard more about her eyes than Mike Singletary's eyes.
Bedroom eyes, I'm of the age where that's just like they're closed all the time.
Right. Bedroom eyes. You mean with that crap in the corner?
Oh, I've got bedroom eyes.
Yeah. I had to rub that crap out every day.
The other great edit in here is when Columbo, he has talked to the girl in the ballet studio, and he goes, well, and you can identify him if you see this person again. She's like, yes. Cut to Adolf Hitler.
Right.
And it's like, what's going on? He's conducting to Adolf Hitler, and he's wearing like a referee outfit. I know it's a 70s shirt, but it's like, and then I realized, okay, they're scoring a documentary.
But still, they could be scoring any documentary. To make the choice of a Hitler documentary was weird.
It's crazy disorienting for that moment, in a way that I love.
Yeah, I don't know if it was on purpose.
Or it's just like, okay, second unit, go just find us footage of anything. Anything.
How about Hitler? Fine. It's that or monkeys. Well, not monkeys.
It's got to be Hitler then.
It's the only things that are free on the shelf over here.
Which probably brings me to my only criticism of this episode is that the red herring of her pointing out Paul the stoner trumpet man is surprising in the moment. I went, ooh. And then everything that followed was sort of a speed bump for the pace of the episode because it came so late. As
however, we
got
the Myrna Loy scene that I love.
You do have that.
That's my favorite scene.
Where he's
But plot-wise and writing-wise,
on the hypocrisy of marijuana prohibition.
It was a great way to see more Myrna Loy, and I loved her performance in that scene. But it is a speed bump storytelling-wise, and you're absolutely right. It's almost unnecessary.
Well, it would have been better placed earlier.
Yep. The red herring was way too late.
I'm a little distracted by trumpet player guy because I can't tell if he has no idea what to do with the trumpet or enough of an idea that he's really trying to show. It's like, that's a lot of spit valve acting.
Yeah.
Yes, there was a lot of spit valve.
I wonder
if
John Cassavetes had him put in to make his conducting look better.
Maybe.
Okay, the last thing I want to mention about this is all music related stuff, because obviously, as we mentioned ad nauseum, he is a conductor. But one thing I really liked, as much as we made fun of the extended murder scene at the top, but I really enjoyed the use of diegetic and non-diegetic music and how it transformed from one to the other as it went. Because it starts with him playing the piano, so that's in the scene, it's diegetic, and then he stops and it's complete silence. There's no soundtrack playing. He moves into the other room and
I admire that panning shot from piano to pointed up the stairs.
And then he plays the record, and that's on in the background. There's a source within the fiction of that music as he's preparing his suicide note and the towel that he's going to wrap the ashtray in. And then he leaves, but that same diegetic music then becomes non-diegetic because it follows him as a soundtrack as he leaves. And the same thing happens after the murder when he's conducting the orchestra, and it cuts between the orchestra being conducted
to
the cops pulling up to check on Jennifer, the murder victim.
And
it's just awesome,
I think. Knocking a door down completely the wrong way. That is a separated shoulder. That cop, that was not a cop. That was an actor
training. Be like, well, check the handle. It's not locked. All right. And I'll put it on my shoulder.
I'm assuming there was a police conductor standing in the background telling him when to go.
He not only went to, we're going to bust this door down quick, but that was completely the wrong way. That is a broken collarbone. That actor probably has a broken collarbone. That's why it cut so fast. Let's look that up.
Do you guys know what an etude is?
Nope.
Nope.
Me neither. No, I do.
Thanks for listening to our podcast.
That's what I Googled while Eric was Googling Beethoven's
Sex Man.
But it is essentially a short musical composition designed to either for one instrument or one player designed to either hone your skill or show it off, which I thought was kind of cool for a conductor who is a murderer and is unfurling his master plan.
All right, because that's French for study, étudier. Oh.
Yeah. See?
I could contribute. All right, we're voting. Is that what's happening now?
Yes.
So here's my thought on our voting system. That if we thought this was the perfect episode, or an episode that has no flaws worth mentioning, we would call this a full confession.
Okay.
Got everything it wanted. Successful across the board. If we thought maybe there's some criticism to be had, a qualified enjoyment of this episode, we might call that a abundance of evidence.
Okay.
If we thought this was pretty dubious episode, can sort of see what it was going for, but didn't necessarily hit the mark, we'd call that a suspicion. And otherwise, we'd just call the episode Not a Clue.
What was the first one again?
First one was Full Confession.
Full Confession. Abundance of evidence. Suspicion, not a clue. So on a scale of 1 to 4.
Yes.
A 1 being Full Confession, 4 being Not a Clue, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this is hard because I need more Columbo to compare it to Columbo.
Is this peak Columbo?
I don't know, because I've probably seen 50 episodes in my life or whatever, but I don't remember any of them. And like I said, I really never studied them while I was watching them or said, I'm going to really analyze this while I'm watching because I have to do a podcast later today. So that's two different ways to watch something, right?
Oh, yes.
I'm going to say it is a full confession from this point of view. I really enjoyed that. Seemed very Columbo-y. Seemed very Peter Falk-y. I loved everything about it. That's what I remember Columbo being. I liked the performances. I loved Myrna Loy. I think all of the perfect murders in Columbo's have, they make huge mistakes.
Flaws,
yeah, right? And I think that from a legal point of view, there's also a lot of flaws in the writing of these shows. There's a lot of legal flaws. So I will say, full confession, that was fantastic. And the winner is Myrna Loy.
I'm going to say it's somewhere between full confession and abundance of evidence. It's very close to full confession for me. And one thing we didn't discuss, which I think this is a fine time to include in our vote, is the wrap up. And that's where I think it loses a little for me, where I think the carnation as evidence is a little light by Columbo standards. And then there's the slight, like I said, pacing speed bump of the red herring of Paul, the stoner trumpeter, being accused of it. But everything else is so good. Yep. And even though I think the evidence Columbo pulls out is a little weaker, that scene is really compelling and strange, the way John Cassavetes plays it.
Yeah.
Right? The way he leans in and whispers those lines to his wife. I still, to this moment, cannot decide if that is meant genuinely or is meant to get her in her head. Because he ends with, like, I wouldn't want you to spend the rest of your life, well, you know. And you could go, questioning whether he ever loved her, or is he just saying, you know, because he wants to just freak her out? What was I supposed to be thinking about? What is there something else? Did you do more than murder somebody? So it's really eerie moment.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's also, he gives up pretty quick.
Well, there's also a question to me of whether he actually confessed.
Right.
Because the only time he confessed was a whisper in his wife's ear.
And then all he said was, I want to go now.
Yeah. And he said to Columbo, I can't remember the exact line, but...
Or when did you know?
Yeah, when did you know? Or you knew this from the beginning, or you decided... I mean, that, in court, that could be anything. That could be... you decided from the very beginning that this is what happened, and you started with your conclusion and worked back to me. So, like, I'm not even sure he's totally confessed, but... We'll set all that aside, and we'll go back to voting. Sorry about that. But I think it's a great scene based on weak Columbo evidence.
That moment is – I'm on the exact same page of you. It's like, this is full confession / abundance of evidence based on that one scene, which to my interpretation of it, and I think it invites theorizing, is that an ongoing theme that had been going on is how – an ongoing theme that's been going on. Yes, that's what ongoing themes do. Anyways, there is the degree to which I can fool the police and the degree to which I can fool my wife.
Oh.
And over, he's losing ground with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And when it gets to that point, and I this is where I wish it had made this decision a little bit more clearly – it's like, I can still fool the police, but my wife sees this now, and I know she knows.
Yes.
And even if I stay out of jail, no matter what the rest of my life is, I'm about to lose my wife.
Yep.
Which was the whole point of doing the murder in the first place.
But was it to keep his wife, or was it to keep his job as the conductor?
Yes.
And that's what we don't know. That's why his saying, I've always loved you.
Either way, what you're saying is, it's over.
Yes. Is he laying the groundwork, though, that if he gets out of this,
right,
he could still be the conductor by saying, I've always loved you?
Nah, that's because of what Myrna Loy's character said. Like,
I'll ax anybody.
I'll ax anybody.
Yeah.
So that's not an option.
You can also see him playing even the most longest shot
sure.
in that last moment.
You know what else is in that scene that was great? That moment where Columbo has the lights turn off and on again and looks at the guard and says, can you operate this?
Oh, yeah, because he says, can you work this for me? He like tries to be as inconspicuous right. about it as possible.
I think it's also subtle that the same producer that he was yelling at earlier is the guy back there who's like, yeah, I can play that screen. Like, oh, sure. You want to see it in slow motion? Yeah.
So long, butt face.
But this is definitely one of my favorite Columbos. I will say that. I have seen it. This is the third time I've seen it. And one of the reasons I'm...
Did you journal before? How do you even know that?
Well, because I really find this captivating because it is an outlier, I think, in that John Cassavetes is not your typical Columbo villain, particularly in his acting style.
Yeah,
well, not the writing, but in his performance style. Yeah. If there are two performance poles for the guest murderers in Columbo, you have John Cassavetes on one end and Jack Cassidy on the other, who's just like, give me more scenery to chew.
Right.
My mustache couldn't get tinier.
That's a really good impression.
Thank you.
It's dead on.
But he is far more naturalistic. He is disturbing and scary in a more real life way. You hate other Columbo villains because they're just so over the top and oily and awful.
Shatner, he's talking about you.
but he's in a sort of area and league by his own, which makes his episode more interesting to me. But I also acknowledge it, like I said, as an outlier. And I have voted for a long time. Yes, and I'm going to pass this off to Tim.
Oh, I agreed with you. That was...
Oh, good.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
So I was actually voting for me and Tim.
Yes.
Thanks. Yes. So I guess that's everything. Thanks for listening.
But wait. Just one more thing.
If you'd like to hear the extended Just One More Thing version of a podcast named Dog, featuring an interview with Monica, a listener and former prosecutor, discussing the legal strengths and weaknesses of Columbo's case, we once again encourage you to visit patreon.com/themorals. Your support makes this podcast possible. Until next time.
Look out!